Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, hour three is here. Let us get back to the phones. The number is 888-914-9149. So I was talking with Joe in Thousand Oaks, California, and we had to take a break. So you were just about to get to your question, Joe. What is that?
So it is such a tremendously complex situation, this entire situation on divorce and remarried, being remarried. And I think of, Moses, he allowed divorce because of the hardness of your heart. Maybe that's somehow where we've made these laws or teachings, which aren't necessarily dogmas within the faith. But I guess part of them are and part of them aren't, because I'm curious primarily how can a bishop give a dispensation for a Catholic, lapsed or not, to be married outside of the church without a priest being the witness? So in other words, is that marriage not always objectively sinful for a Catholic to be married outside of the church in a sacramental form? Or can it sometimes be considered, because of this dispensation without a priest there, that it is a valid marriage? So then, in other words, the couples would not be living in a state of adultery, or they're not making a mockery of the sacrament. Or I'm just trying to comprehend that, because I do have that within my own family. And it seems to be an ongoing situation where there's so many people now that in my family, this extended family, they're lapsed. So I don't think they'd be able to get a dispensation regardless. And I don't think they want to. And parish that I do belong to, a priestly fraternity parish as well. And that priest stated very simply for me that I would be to even go there in order to keep peace within the family, if I took part even in the celebration, that I would be celebrating something that would be objectively sinful, so that there really isn't any way for me to ever attend to this. And this is going to cause terrible discord within the extended family.
Yeah.
But it's such a difficult situation. It's almost like, I guess I would need to read Mr. Peter's book on this, but it just seems like it's certainly not in the catechism stating anything where someone as myself cannot attend a wedding of a lapsed Catholic, and stating, I couldn't really find it. Maybe I'm incorrect on that, but it is causing me a lot of consternation on how to process all of this.
I can understand. I've never been through that personally, but the day will probably come for me when I'll have to make the same kind of difficult choice. So one thing I'd like to point out, Joe, to your earlier question, keeping in mind that the sacrament is not given by the priest or the deacon, it is given to each other by the husband and wife. So the husband confers the sacrament on the wife, she confers the sacrament on her husband. Now, the church does foresee, and the church's law specifies, that there are certain circumstances where if there is no priest and the couple wants to get married, they have a right to get married, and if there is some undue length of time that would elapse before a priest might visit the area. So let's think about a remote location where there are very few priests, and maybe he only visits that parish once every 6 months or something like that. I think the rule of thumb that the church gives in canon law, I'd have to go back and double check, is 1 month or more. So if the couple wants to get married, they can be validly married, even if they're not married in a church, even if they're not married with the official minister of the church to officiate and bless the marriage. But those are unusual circumstances. But in terms of the sacramental theology of marriage, that there are situations where you can get married not in the canonical form because of the circumstances. that are beyond your control. But under normal circumstances. Go ahead.
Yeah, and that's normally a couple that's still within the faith, still loves the church. They follow the church. They follow the teachings. But, yes, maybe very rural areas and limited priests, and they need to get married. A man's going off to war or something like that. But in a situation where you have actual lapsed Catholics, they certainly wouldn't seek this dispensation, in my situation, to attend that. Is it only scandalous, or is it actually celebrating what would be objectively sinful because they've renounced the faith and they're acting as if they're married, but since they're lapsed, again, I mean, they're speaking against the very sacrament of the faith that they once belonged to, that they no longer belong to. So it is, you know, this does create tremendous discord in a family where you may be closing the door for further conversation, and maybe they turn more against the faith. But, you know, Christ spoke very clearly that we would have these difficulties at time, and you know, love Christ more than, you know, brother, sister, father, and mother, so to speak.
Well, I was actually, if I can jump in, I was actually trying to answer that question. I was going in that direction.
Yeah.
So I wanted to give the kind of the background framework of when, because that was your original question. Is there ever a case when they can get married validly and not observe the canonical form? So that's what I was trying to answer, that first question. But as to your second question, if you're talking about just lapsed Catholics who are negligent, they don't really care, they don't go to Mass anymore, the church regards them as still Catholic. I mean, if assuming that they've received their sacraments of initiation. So whether they realize it or not, or like it or not, they still have the obligation to do what the church requires on this issue. Now, my understanding is that in the case of somebody who publicly repudiates the faith, so publicly renounces being Catholic in some fashion, then that would put them in a different category. And if I'm understanding the church's law correctly, you'd have to double check with a canon lawyer. And I think actually Ed Peters does cover that topic in his book on annulments and remarriage. But as I understand it, in that kind of an extreme situation, then the church would say that that person is no longer bound by this requirement because of this terrible step that he or she has taken. But that doesn't sound like this is what you're talking about. It sounds like you're dealing with people who are just lazy and they no longer really care or believe, and yet they're still Catholic. So you're right about the pain and the anguish and the division and all of these things. Jesus himself said, this is what will happen. And it's painful, to be sure. But it doesn't mean thereby, or therefore, that just because it's painful and people get angry, that you just cave in and go along to get along. This is the essence of being a real witness to Jesus if we're his followers. And I know you believe this, Joe. I'm not saying this to you, but maybe somebody listening needs to hear this. If you're serious about being a follower of Jesus, then follow him. And if somebody gets in your face and says, well, you're making me angry because you're following Jesus and you're not following what I want to do, you have to follow Jesus. And anything short of that is, to my mind, at least, a kind of betrayal. So it's a form of martyrdom. Thankfully, you and I are not likely anyway to be asked to take a bullet or have our heads cut off or something to shed our blood for Jesus. But these are smaller forms of martyrdom that involve pain and suffering that faithful followers of Jesus will be willing to undergo, even though they won't like it. So I recognize the pain that you're talking about.
And this is such a, there's so many nuances within this, so we could probably discuss it forever. Just in my personal family, we have a very large extended family, and there seems to be three of us that seem to be kind of in my position, so to speak, to where we just know that we cannot attend this wedding, but there's 15 or 20 that will. And of course, they're using that as that we're just, you know, then they want to point out all your other little personal failings. And how can you say this? And it just becomes very very complicated, very sad. It's breaking the hearts, certainly, of my mother. And
I understand. It's a very, very common thing that you're describing. It doesn't make it any easier, but it's very common. And it's sad because it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be this way. And as I said yesterday, I think it was Joe. And hey, Joe, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. And do say hello to that Catholic couple with 11 kids that was on the cruise with us last week. Very lovely people. Thanks for your call. It doesn't have to be this way. And to kind of recap what I said yesterday when I was appealing to men and women who are getting married, you know, why be stubborn? Why insist upon not doing a simple thing? No skin off your back. You go to church. You have the marriage ceremony. You profess your vows in front of the official minister of the church. And then you go have your big party and mariachis and tacos or whatever else you want to do. Do it at the beach. Do it in the mountains. Ask yourself this question. What is it that is making you say no to your parents, to the church, to Jesus? I mean, just analyze your motives. Why would you not be willing to do something so simple? Well, it's my day and I want to do it my... Great, do it your way. It's your day. Everybody believes that. Do it your way. No one's going to interfere with what you want to do. The church is just saying, as a Catholic, you have an obligation to do this one thing. It's not difficult, and the church will make it as easy as possible for you. And I realize I'm repeating myself from yesterday, but I think it's worth repeating. Ask yourself, why are you unwilling to do something that could make it so easy and happy for your mom and dad and your brothers and sisters and everybody else to be there at your wedding and celebrate because they can do so with a clear conscience? Why would you not want that? Why would you insist upon saying, nope, I'm not going to do that? And then you now have put your family into a quandary. Think of the division and the hurt and the resentment and the recriminations, like Joe was talking about a few minutes ago. Some of the family now mad at him because he's not going to go to the wedding. That's not his fault. Young people, men and women, that would be your fault. You personally would be at fault for that. And the division and the problems that would arise from that, that's not your parents' fault. It's your fault. And I hate to be so blunt about it, but I guess I'm speaking to you as if I were your father. And I'm here to tell you, you will be the one at fault for causing those problems in your family. And you don't have to do that. It doesn't have to be that way. So just be humble and be docile and be loving and recognize that by saying, yes, I will have my marriage in the church and then we'll go have a big old party after that, you will be preventing all kinds of problems that could last the rest of your life. So just, as the song says, find a little love in your heart and do the right thing. That's my advice anyway. Let's go to Ruby in El Paso. Good morning, Ruby.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a question. My current husband asked me for a divorce.
Okay.
And he's going through a drinking binge.
Oh, boy.
And And apparently, this is something that I go through with him twice a year, and he always asks for a divorce.
Every year he asks for a divorce?
Yes.
And I'm not laughing because it's funny. I'm laughing because it's astonishing.
Yes. And we got married through the church 4 years ago because I was married before and I had to get an annulment.
Okay. So this husband you have now, it has a drinking problem, right?
Yes.
Does he, when he gets drunk, does he do other bad things? Like, does he hit you or hurt you or do something else like that?
Well, actually, for the first time, he did lay hands on me a couple of days ago.
How so?
He started pushing me. Mm-hmm. And he started pushing me and pushing me. And I was just because I honestly have a bad temper and I try to keep myself calm because I could have hit him. But I decided not to because I thought if I hit him, he'll call the police and then I'll get arrested. So I just stood there and I kept falling, like, because he kept pushing me onto the bed. And I told, and I had surgery on my hand, and I kept telling him, you're going to hurt my hand. And he's like, I want to hurt your hand. I want to hurt you. And realized that I wasn't reacting, mm-hmm. when I wasn't reacting to him with anger, he stopped.
I think, Ruby, that you're sort of on the edge of what could become really bad really quickly. So the first thing is, I would get into, and if he's willing to do this, him too, and more especially him, get into some marriage therapy, get into some serious counseling so that you and he together, or at least him, can work through this problem. Because it sounds as though you're standing on the brink of what will likely become more violence, and you need to be safe from that. You know, if he's already crossed that line and he's now inflicting bodily harm on you, I realize pushing, but still pushing is over the line. If he's shoving you, he's crossed the line. So this is a situation that could spiral out of control quickly, and I'm concerned about your safety. So that would be my first thing I would do. I would get people involved right away. Don't suffer in silence. Don't hide this. If it's escalating and the physical violence is taking place, you need to make sure that you are safe. So if it sounds like he's crossed this line into what would be criminal activity, you know, physical abuse of a spouse is a crime. So if, mm-hmm. and only you can make this judgment, I can't make it for you, but it sounds like that's what you're saying, in which case then you should get the authorities involved. And maybe that'll get his attention and help start the process of him de-escalating. I don't know, but I would do that. Don't try to go it alone. You know what I'm saying?
No, and I told, yes, sir. And I did tell my family, and I should have called the police, but I don't know. I just didn't. And now I'm worried because he has stopped working, but I think today he finally went to work. And
I guess my concern, Ruby, is go ahead.
We've done the counseling, and he doesn't like the counselor because the counselor doesn't agree with what he says.
Right.
And then he stops going.
Right. This sounds like it's deteriorating, and I just don't want you to be caught and hurt any more than you already have been. And you have mm-hmm. to, we had a really good email from a retired law enforcement guy who
I heard it yesterday.
You heard that one? Okay.
Yes, sir.
So he used a term that I think is very applicable here. He talks about, I think he's put it this way, breaking the cycle. You have to disrupt mm-hmm. this syndrome. You have to disrupt this cycle. Because if you stay in this cycle, it's just going to get worse and worse. And eventually you're going to get really badly hurt, it sounds like. So I would take that law enforcement officer's advice and break this cycle. You have to disrupt it and hope that things can get better. And maybe they will. But I don't see things getting any better if you stay the way you are right now.
Right. Because I personally don't want to get a divorce, but I also don't want to keep living like this.
Right, right. You don't have to live like that.
Because when I first got divorced from my first husband, I didn't receive Jesus. I did everything by the church. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing I keep thinking of is if I get divorced, if I grant them the divorce, I won't be able to receive Jesus. And that breaks my heart because I go to daily mass.
You can receive Jesus if, see, first of all, you're in a the church presumes you're in a valid marriage. And so you have the right to live as husband and wife with your husband. Now, he has forfeited that right by crossing this line now and hurting you physically. He has actually forfeited his right to conjugal life with you. Now, hopefully, he'll get his head screwed on straight and stop doing this and repent and become a good husband. That's what we can hope for, right? But in the meantime, you have the right in the eyes of the church, if necessary, to separate from him. If he's hurting you, if he's physically harming you, you have that right to do that. And then if the counseling helps and he repents and gets back on track again, then let's hope that there's reconciliation and you can move forward as a married couple. But only time will tell. And only, you know, it's,
right,
of course, his willingness to see the problem and work on it and fix it. But in the meantime, though, my advice to you would be you need to be safe from this violence in the home. And those are some things you can do by talking to the police, by getting in touch with a good counselor. You yourself, I think, probably need to have that counseling as well. Okay?
Okay, I will. Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome. You're in the Diocese of El Paso. Get in touch with the diocese. And you can go on their website and find the Marriage and Family Office. Get in touch with them and have them refer you to a good counselor for marriage therapy. And they'll help you.
Okay, I will do that.
Okay. All right,
I will
Ruby.
Do that. Thank you very much. God bless you. Thank you
God
for
bless
your show.
You. You're welcome. I'm glad we can be here for you, Ruby. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
888-914-9149. Let's go to Kathleen now in Frisco, Texas. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Kind of going way back to when you spoke about baptism, that you said, what I heard you say was that baptism, once you're baptized as Catholic, then it's good for like other churches where like my son was born. Was baptized a Catholic, lived a Catholic and devoutly. We were homeschooled and he was very into his faith. And then he met a girl who's Protestant and sadly converted to, oddly enough, they converted to Eastern Orthodoxy. Mm. And so as a practicing Orthodox, he was rebaptized. And that's just, I don't understand it. And it's actually very hurtful to us. And so we actually live, have his kids. He's a dad of four and we're very active grandparents and they're very devout Christians. But it is difficult to understand. It's hurtful that he's, has rebaptized. And I guess my question is, can you explain that or help me understand that? And also,
Yeah, sure. I'll do my best. So, yeah, I share your sadness in that he left the Catholic Church and became, is it Greek Orthodox or which Orthodox church did he go into?
I think he started off with Bulgarian Orthodox. I think it's Russian Orthodox now.
Russian Orthodox. Okay, so the first thing to note is that you can't be rebaptized. If you're validly baptized, then anything after that is just a simulation of baptism. It's not baptism. So assuming that he was validly baptized, and you would know because you were his mom and you were there.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is just, it's just a pantomime. And the Eastern Orthodox churches know this. They know that baptism is permanent and unrepeatable. This, to me, is part of the bigger problem that exists and has existed for over 1,000 years now, and that is this deep-seated antipathy, even in some cases, I'm sorry to say, a hatred of the Catholic Church by some Eastern Orthodox believers. Not all, maybe not even most, but some. Who go out of their way to impugn the Catholic Church and deny valid sacraments and insist on rebaptizing, none of which is necessary or true. But some of them have just such a deep antipathy, if not a hatred, toward the Catholic Church that it drives them to do stupid things like that. And the odd thing of all of it is that they are the ones who left the Catholic Church in the first place. Now, they would point a finger and say, no, the Catholic Church left them, and I'm familiar with the polemic, and I've dealt with it for many years. But suffice to say, it's hugely ironic that the ones who left the Catholic Church, and this, of course, is historical, it's not something they themselves did, that they would take this attitude toward the church. But in any case, they do. So I can understand why this would be hurtful to you. I'm guessing, I'm hoping that your son didn't really understand everything that was at stake, but it's sufficient to know that this attempt at baptism in the Orthodox Church was not a baptism. It was a simulation of a baptism. It wasn't real. It was a pantomime with all the best intentions.
Yeah. And then his kids are, I mean, very, and he even at times when he can't go to the Orthodox Church, he'll go with us. He does not receive communion, but he'll go with us. He'll join in with us with certain prayers. He'll pray the Hail Mary. He'll pray the Our Father with us. And, but he, it's difficult. Like, we go to St. Francis of Assisi Catholic Church, and we have a great devotion to Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta, St. Teresa of Calcutta, and, you know, all the saints of modern day. And but it's very difficult. He's not rude about it, but it's how do you just acknowledge that they don't recognize all these incredibly holy people as saints?
I would recommend a book, if he's willing to read it. I doubt he would be, but the book is by a former Greek Orthodox believer. His name is James Likudis, L-I-K-O-U-D-I-S. James Likudis. The book is called Ending the Byzantine Greek Schism. Now, the Byzantine Greek Schism extends to the Russian Orthodox Church as well, because the Russian Orthodox Church is related, after a fashion, to the Greek Orthodox Church. They're autocephalous, so they each claim to be independent of one another. But in any case, the history of the Russian Orthodox Church goes back to the Greek Orthodox Church. But in any case, that book is his appeal as a convert from Greek Orthodoxy to the Catholic Church. He's explaining to his family and friends and whoever's reading the book why he did this, and why so many of these claims and notions and arguments that are raised against the Catholic Church by the Eastern Orthodox simply don't hold water. That's one book. Another book is called Jesus, Peter, and the Keys. And that book has a few co-authors. David Hess is, you might say, the primary co-author. Jesus, Peter, and the Keys is a compilation of patristic testimony, primarily from the Eastern churches, what we would think of today as the Orthodox churches in those geographical areas, attesting to the primacy of the Bishop of Rome and showing that it was not some Latin invention that was concocted as a way to keep control over the Greek-speaking Catholics. And that, too, that book helps in many ways to set the record straight, to show that some of these Orthodox claims against the Catholic Church are historically invalid. And you can demonstrate that from the writings of these church fathers from the East. So that, too, might be a book that you want to get a hold of. And then thirdly would be a book by Father Aidan Nichols, N-I-C-H-O-L-S. He's a Dominican scholar. He teaches in Cambridge in England. And he wrote a wonderful book called Rome in the Eastern Churches. And it, too, is very helpful in terms of delineating some of these issues that are at stake. I'll let you wrap things up, Kathleen, before I had to head forward.
Okay, one other quick thing is, what's the difference then? Because when he was little, we at times did go to the Byzantine Catholic Church, mm-hmm. Appears on the outside very similar to an Eastern Orthodox. But what would be, I mean, I don't know if we went wrong there, because then
he... No, you didn't. Yeah. No, you didn't. If that was a Byzantine Catholic Church, you certainly didn't do anything wrong. And to your point, yes, that is what Greek Orthodoxy, or depending upon which rite you went to, so was it maybe Ruthenian Byzantine or some of the various Byzantine churches within the Byzantine rite. The point is, those are churches that came back into communion. They left Eastern Orthodoxy and came back into communion with the Catholic Church. And they were permitted to retain all of their liturgical customs and their language and all of it, but they resumed union with the Catholic Church. So in essence, when you attend a divine liturgy at, let's say, a Byzantine parish, and you have the right to do that if you wish, that's you're looking at what Eastern Orthodoxy would look like if it came back into communion with the Catholic Church. So nothing
wrong
there.
That's what I pray he will do if that's, he's very, very passionate. I think part of it is I heard someone, another caller say that in the time of certain, we try to be in a Orthodox, if you will, in the small O church, a traditional Catholic church, but there wasn't one available at a certain time in our history. And I think he just desperately wanted to seek the truth, and he wanted more liturgical. So that's, I think, one of the reasons.
I don't look askance at his motives, because I think those are worthy motives to want a beautiful, reverent, traditional liturgy. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. Unfortunately, maybe without a lot of information, he thought he was doing the right thing when in fact he was doing the wrong thing, but I'm assuming he probably didn't know that. But there's always hope, and continue being gentle and persuasive and loving and praying for him, and perhaps in due time he will make his way back into the Catholic Church. I think those books will be useful in any case. Thank you. We'll go now to, where are we going to go? Let's go to Michelle in Phoenix. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, good morning. I have children who are all raised in the Catholic faith, and one of them is talking, where you had been speaking about Catholics who don't get married in the Catholic Church, and you just say, well, make us happy and do what God wants as your obligation for being Catholic, get married in the Catholic Church. Wouldn't the church then say, well, you need to take classes and you need to do other things? It wouldn't just be, they just walk in and get married, right?
Right. Yeah, there would be marriage prep that they would need to go through.
Oh, okay. See, that's where I see them dragging their feet.
Right. I know. Well, it's so sad, really, because, you know, these young people, they don't realize the beautiful gift of the church that they have. And they, I don't think it's so much that they know what this beautiful gift is and they don't want it. I just don't think they know that they have this gift. And so for them, it's just like, why do I have to go through those hoops? You know, why do I have to do that? And water seeks the path of least resistance, doesn't it? So the path of least resistance is, let's just get this done. Let's get, you know, plan the wedding and go do it and have fun. And they don't really give a lot of thought to the liturgical and sacramental and theological meaning of what they're doing. Sad to say.
Yes, I agree. Well, please pray for us.
I will. We're all in this big boat together, and sometimes, man, it can be really difficult, but keep your chin up.
Thank you.
Keep going forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. How about Mary now in southern Minnesota? Minnesota. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Patrick. I'm calling because I have an opposite problem of so many people who call whose children have left the church, and I feel that I should be grateful for this situation rather than seeing it as a problem.
Okay. What's the situation?
A couple years ago, my son and his family were drawn to an FFSP parish and have become their parishioners there. Okay. My husband and I attended there a few times, and we are not drawn to that parish.
Okay.
So this has kind of resulted in a little bit of an unspoken, I don't know if I want to say divide, but, you know, a difference. So when their last child was baptized there, I really struggled. And now, thanks be to God, their new baby will be baptized there this weekend.
Okay.
So I'm calling to ask you to help me understand this and attend this baptism with an open heart, because I'm struggling with it.
Fair enough. If I can ask, what is it that is causing you to struggle? What about the baptism or maybe whatever the other issue is that's causing you to struggle?
Well, our family attended the same parish together for many years. And of course, that, you know, was our Sunday thing. We went to church together and ended up at one another's homes for dinner or whatever. And that was Sunday. And now since this change, we don't share that anymore. And of course, occasionally we do go to church together, but it's not a regular thing like it was. And there are things, you know, there are things that come up when we discuss church that, of course, their children now recognize their practice is pretty different from ours. And it's difficult. It's...
This is maybe where I'm drawing a blank, Mary. What is difficult for you? That the Mass is celebrated in Latin, or that it's the traditional form of the sacraments? Is that bothersome to you?
Well, it bothers me that we don't share that anymore. My husband.
What happened? I mean, maybe that's the missing piece of the puzzle here. You once were going to that parish, and now you're not. Did something happen that drove you away?
No. We were always in a traditional Catholic parish together.
Okay.
And a couple of years ago, it actually happened around the time of COVID, that they were drawn to this FFSP parish.
Oh, I thought you meant that that's where you first went. Okay, got it.
No.
Okay.
Parish to attend an FFSP parish. And we've gone there a few times, although we appreciate the beauty, that is not the way we feel we want to worship every Sunday. And so we don't join them regularly.
Okay.
And at the baptism.
Well, that was my question. Sorry to interrupt you, but that was my question. Is it because the Mass is in Latin, or because they kneel at a communion rail to receive Holy Communion, or what about that is bothersome to you?
Well, it is the Latin. It's not the traditional. I mean, we love the traditional music. We love the tradition of kneeling at the communion rail and receiving on the tongue, and we do that in our parish, and we're happy about those kinds of things. It's the Latin and the feeling like you don't have a clue what is happening, you know, that it's very, very, we just feel so removed from it. And at the last baptism, we felt like we just were removed, I guess is the only word. I don't know how else to describe it. We just didn't feel like we were a part of it at all.
Fair enough. I mean, sometimes feelings are, they're just there, and you can't deny that they're there. I'm sorry that you have that experience. My thought on this issue, Mary, would be, number one, if you thought of it like if you went to Europe and you went to Mass some Sunday in a language that you didn't know,
yep.
You're still at Mass, you're still in the presence of Jesus, you're still in the bosom of the church, you're still receiving the sacrament and all the graces, even though you're removed because you don't know the language, you can still participate. And I know that in the typical Latin Mass parishes, they have typically their red paperback booklets that will have the English on one side and the Latin on the other. So it's very easy to follow throughout the whole Mass and see exactly where you are and exactly what's being said. I don't know if they offer those, but my experience is they're pretty common. So when you're there again for this baptism, if you wanted to follow along, it's easy to do, and you can know exactly what's being said in English by following along that way. So that's a workaround, and I realize if it's not your cup of tea, fair enough, and you're happy and you enjoy the Mass as it is in your parish, that's understandable. I don't knock that at all. But I guess if I had to offer any advice, if that's what you're asking me for, it would be if you thought of this as an act of love and make a sacrifice for the sake of your son and his family, and do a little something that will be a sacrifice for you, I think that's meritorious in God's eyes. I think it's a beautiful sign of humility, just as if it were going the other direction, and your son who likes the FSSP parish and maybe making an act of humility and a little sacrifice if he were attending your parish out of love, being willing to embrace this, I think that's a beautiful thing. And it doesn't cost you anything. You know, you can go and smile and be happy and love Jesus and pray and all the rest and make this little act of sacrifice. I think that would be a positive, life-giving thing. And then next Sunday, you're back at your parish. And it hasn't cost you anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I guess that's what we've done up until this point. I just wish I felt better about it, or I wish I knew how to resolve this in my heart that it's okay that they've chosen that path and we haven't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can understand. That would be vexing. Well, obviously, the more you ask the Lord to help you, the more He will.
You know. Okay.
Change is difficult, and sacrifice is not easy. But I think that spirit of sacrifice and love on your part would go a long way, not only to maybe the situation smoothing out, but also your own feelings smoothing out.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome, Mary. You're welcome. You have my deep empathy for the situation, and I'll pray for you. I hope you'll pray for me too, okay?
Thank you.
All right, you're welcome. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. Please don't go anywhere. This hour is sponsored by Christendom College. Send your child to Christendom College's high school summer program, the best week ever. Get 50% off by using the promo code RELEVANTRADIO. Spots fill up very quickly, so apply today at thebestweekever.com.
At the intersection of faith and culture, the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
I'm not going to be able to read all of your emails that have come in the last, I don't know, hour or so. I've gotten an avalanche of emails from you about, what was her name? Barbara. Barbara's call sparked a lot of commentary from people, positive generally, and I appreciate it. But there's so many, probably at least 25 emails that have come in just on that one topic in the last hour or so. So I just want to acknowledge your emails. And during the breaks, I've been reading them. So thank you for that, even if I'm not able to read them on the air. Let's go now to Jeremy in Clearwater, Minnesota. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, how are we doing?
We are doing fine, Jeremy. Welcome.
Terrific. So a couple weekends ago, I was talking to an old friend of mine who is a priest, and his parish asked him, or diocese or something like that, asked him to study canon law.
Okay.
And one thing that I said, what's the most shocking thing that you can tell me about canon law? And we were talking about divorces and people getting their annulments. And I said, you know, it's all based on, I guess, there's so many people who get so frustrated, so-and-so got an annulment and they shouldn't have gotten an annulment. They had, you know, so-and-so. I said, well, how does they determine an annulment? And what we concluded with, and the point of this, is that he said, what you got to realize is an annulment is based on the information that the people are given. And He said it's not infallible. So when people get worked up because somebody gets so, you know, somebody got an annulment and in their eyes it wasn't just, it wasn't reasonable, it doesn't make any sense. Well, how could they have gotten that? And then they get mad at the Catholic Church about it. But in all reality, I mean, there could be just reason to be mad at the Church. There may not be. But at the end of the day, what the church is based on is the information that they're given. So if so-and-so got an annulment and they shouldn't have gotten an annulment, but they did because they lied or gave false representation of themselves or the other person, at the end of the day, it's between them and God, like Mother Teresa said.
Yeah, that's
true.
You
know, so when people get so worked up, you know, yeah, you cheated the church. You cheated your spouse. You got away with it, and you got your piece of paper, so you can get remarried. You can even get remarried back in the Catholic Church because they're going on what you told them. But
yeah,
at
I get
it.
I get it.
It's going to be between
it.
You and God anyway.
Yeah, God will not be mocked, and you can't fool God, you know, and you may get away with it in the eyes of other people for a while, but eventually it will catch up with you. I agree. I think you're right on target.
Yeah, so I was just curious what you thought about that and if there was anything that I was incorrect about, but it just seems people get so upset with it, but in reality, what do you expect the church to do? They can't decipher, I think this person's lying. I think this person has ill will. Are they doing on a regular?
I have personal knowledge, Jeremy, of an annulment process that took place in which I have moral certitude that the tribunal reached the right decision, but for the wrong reasons. and that the reasons that they determined that the marriage was null were not the right reasons. But there were, in fact, reasons for the marriage to be null. So I do believe they reached the right conclusion, but for the wrong reason. And okay, you know, as you say, marriage tribunals are not infallible. But the key here is that if the parties go through this process and are honest, even if one lies, if the other one doesn't know that, for example, or the other one is truthful, the fact is, if the couple receives this declaration from the church, they have a moral certitude that they are free to remarry. Even if, perhaps, you know, in light of eternity, it turns out otherwise, they're not committing a sin because they're in good faith doing what Correct. The church says that they can do. That, to me, is the bottom
line.
They're
not aware of it.
Right.
Because it's just like the three things that you need for it to be a mortal sin. You have to be aware of it. And if in good faith they got their annulment, and I'm definitely not saying anything about that. Just the simple fact of that they're not infallible. It's based on the information they're given. The church can only do so much, and they're assuming the information they're given is true to a point. And I thought that
was
really
interesting. You do the best you can. Yeah, exactly. In other words, you do the best you can. God does not expect the impossible. So if you make an honest effort, you're forthright, you're honest, you're not trying to game the system, and the church returns a declaration of nullity, well, you have moral certitude. You can't have absolute certitude. Only God has that. But God doesn't expect that from us. So excellent points, Jeremy. I'm glad you called in today. Thank you. Let's get over to Jim now in Pittsburgh. Good morning, Jim. Welcome.
Thank you for all that you do for us followers, Christ followers, I should say. Hey, I had a conversation yesterday with a Jehovah Witness trying to witness to me and talk to me about the truth. And, you know, I try to, you're actually rubbing off a little bit, I think, by listening to you. I went back and I just started to try to understand or try to explain to him, listen, you know, the early church fathers, go back to the early church fathers, start looking at that. And he would have nothing of that. He kept wanting to mention the Jehovah. The name Jehovah was taken out of the Bibles years ago. I tried to explain to him, you know, I tried to ask some questions about who wrote the Bibles, where did it come from? Because my point was, you know, if you believe in the Bible, which he says he does, and then when did you stop distrusting the people who put the Bible together was my next conversation. But that didn't work out. And so anyways, you know, and then I ended it with him basically saying that I believed it was man-made religion. This is why I won't even look at his booklet, because it's a man-made religion started in 1800, whatever. I want to follow, and I believe in Jesus' religion, the one he started, and that's why I'm with the Catholic faith, you know. Anyways, could you give me clarification on two things? Because two things he said, I wasn't sure how to respond, so I didn't respond. He brought up the 144,000 sealed in Revelation. He was, you know, basically saying only 144,000 people go to heaven. Everybody else, you know, is risen and back on earth, whatever. And the second thing was, the stumper for me was the name Jehovah. He's trying to tell me that Jehovah is the name of God and was taken out. I can't really get any clarification on when that was used, you know, when Jehovah Witness started using it and why, you know?
Yeah, I can help you. So the background here is that the progenitor of the Jehovah's Witnesses, known originally as the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society, Charles Taze Russell, he was the founder of Jehovah's Witnesses in the mid-19th century. And he had lots of really odd esoteric ideas about pyramids and numerology and things. And so when he was developing what came to be the Jehovah's Witness religion, there were certain things that he taught based upon his misinterpretation of the Bible. And this idea of 144,000 is one of them. So in Revelation 14, it talks about the 144,000, and these are male virgins who have not defiled themselves with women. This is in verse 4. They are chaste. It is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. And in their mouth no lie was found, for they are spotless. So what he did was, he seized upon this passage and another passage in Revelation chapter 7, and he said, well, these are the ones who will be in heaven with Jehovah God. Everyone else is going to be on paradise earth. And this is the whole point of the Jehovah's Witness shtick when they come to your home with Watchtower magazine and Awake magazine. On this point, this is what they are saying, is that if you become a Jehovah's Witness and if you are baptized into the Jehovah's Witness organization, when Armageddon comes, and by the way, it's right around the corner, everyone's about to die really soon. If you are a Jehovah's Witness, then you are going to survive this and you will live on paradise earth forever. You won't be in heaven. That's where the 144,000 are going to be. But you get to enjoy picking fruit and petting animals forever, because that's all you're going to be able to do is pick fruit and pet animals on paradise earth. So this is an example of Charles Taze Russell's misunderstanding of the Bible. Those who are destined to go to heaven will be in heaven with God, and that'll be a massive number of people. We don't know how many people that will be. You won't be living on paradise earth. Now, they also confuse this with in Revelation 22 and 21 about the new heavens and the new earth, and they think incorrectly that there will be some people on the earth part and some people in the heaven part. But they misunderstand it, because the new heavens and the new earth that are described there are merged into one single reality. So the physical realm that we know, which is distinct from and we can't see into, you might say, the supernatural realm, the heavens, the Bible, what it's saying there is that the two seemingly separate realities are going to merge into one unified reality, and you will experience this for all eternity bodily and spiritually, because your body and soul will be reunited. There's just so much here that is wrong that it requires a lot more time than I have right now. As far as the issue of the name of God, nobody knows the actual name of God. Jehovah is just one possible version of it. In Exodus chapter 3, we see God give this name to Moses. There's so much more to say. I'll have to leave it at that, but call me another time. I'd like to delve into this topic more deeply with you if you're interested. Until then, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.
I want you to know it's over.
Well.